Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Hilla Kerner. She joined Vancouver Rape Relief 13 years ago. Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter is the longest-standing rape crisis center in Canada. Since 1973, the group, who is self-organized as a collective, has responded to close to 46,000 women seeking support in their escape from male violence. Since they opened their transition house in 1981, they've housed over 3,000 women and over 2,600 children. So first, thank you for doing that incredibly important work in the world. And second, thank you for being on the program.
Of course.
So before we dive into current events, can you talk for a while about the history of Vancouver Rape Relief and especially about the importance of rape relief centers? Why are they necessary? What do they do? How do they help?
So, of course, I wasn't here, but the story goes as three local women in 1973, as part of the second wave of the feminist movement in North America, through a consciousness-raising process, decided simultaneously to many other places to open a rape crisis center. And it started with a crisis line of a few hours and proceeded to many more hours and eventually a transition house, because I think that until the early 70s, even though other issues for 100, 150 years, the suffrage fight, women's economy, other issues that has to do with women oppression were spoken in some circles, violence against women was quite a taboo. And only when women met in women-only small groups for consciousness raising, they revealed to each other how common the experience of male violence, whether it's incest or rape in marriage or sexual harassment to women who did have a job, and how common it is to be a victim of male violence, and how it's one of the harshest reflections and reinforcement of women's oppression. So in that context, Vancouver Rape Relief, again, like other organizations, around the Western world started, and the collective was very mindful to operate as a collective, and it's quite unique. I think many services and many organizations at the time started like that, but many, because of all kinds of internal conflicts, but also funding schemes by the government that had all kind of requirements, they either dissolved or changed their structure, but Rape Relief maintained its structure as a collective, which is our attempt to, when we fight for a world with no power relations, not between men and women, not between white people over people of color and indigenous people, and changing relationship between rich and poor so all people will have their equal share of the world wealth. It was really important for the group at the time and since that we will try, at least within ourselves, to operate the way we want the world to be. So I think being a collective is quite a unique phenomenon these days, and to sustain it for so many years. And of course, responding to male violence against women, to women escaping violence, and we respond to all forms of male violence against women. We have battered women mainly staying in our transition house, but often we have women who are in prostitution, either trying to exit or just getting a respite from a pimp or from a John. We have a woman. We have women who've been raped, and even though they're safe in their homes, they want to recover, to heal, and to talk with the comfort of other women. We respond to women who've been sexually harassed at the workplace, helping them with the Human Rights Tribunal, mother who are trying to save their daughters from incest so they will leave abusive husbands and abusive fathers. And we offer peer counseling based on our shared experiences. Women who were born females and raised as girls into our current womanhood, and support group and advocacy with the criminal justice system, organizing protests, confrontations, lobbying, all kinds of strategies, depend what the woman and what she would like to do. And I think Rape Crisis Center and Transition Houses have a role not just to the individual women who are calling us, but also as an organizing center of women coming together especially when we talk about violence against women, isolation and silencing is such a powerful tool of the oppressor. So by calling us, it's an act of resistance. By telling what happened, by telling the truth, by us keeping a record, is already an element of resistance. But also, beyond responding to individual women and offering them a safe place to go, and comforting organizing center, it's also the existence of transition houses and rape crisis centers are also sending a message to men. They're telling men, women are not alone, women have alternative, women have where to go, which we believe, which we hope, give individual women sometimes more bargaining power when they negotiate or dealing with individual men.
You know, as you're talking here, I keep thinking about my own mother, and you know, my father was extremely violent, and my brother has epilepsy from blows to the head. He broke my sister's arm. He raped my mother, my sister, and me. And one of the reasons that my mother stayed with my father until the late 60s, early 70s, is because back in the 50s and 60s, there weren't these centers, for the most part, didn't exist. And
right.
Had a center like this existed anywhere near her, her life would have been completely different.
Yes, absolutely. And we have stickers across the city in ugly neon yellow saying, so they will be visible on street posts, saying, women, do you want to change women's lives, starting with yours, come volunteer with us and with our contact. And someone recently in a handwriting, wrote on the sticker, this woman's group saved my life. And it's, in this particular case, it's probably a woman we supported, but it's a key message from many women. Transition houses and rape crisis centers are still probably the only mean to save women's lives, because even though the women's movement has now 50 years of trying to press state agents to protect women and to hold men accountable, it's very, very weak, and it's usually a failure. So at the moment, the direct action, the feminist second wave tool to save women's lives, is still the most effective one.
My mother recently died, and I've been thinking so much about how strong she was and how through the 50s and 60s, as she was being battered, she was she was in it by herself, because much of her family didn't believe her, and she didn't have police support, she didn't have community support, she didn't have church support. And I mean, I'm just saying this in terms of, we all know, and can you talk about this for a moment, how abusers often isolate their victims. And so that makes places like rape relief centers or battered women's shelters all the more important, because it's not an accident that so many women who are being abused are in it by themselves.
Right. Silencing and isolation are really, really powerful tool of the oppressor. Absolutely. And I see any woman who pick up the phone and call us already a woman in resistance. That's how we see them, because it's breaking the silence and it's breaking the isolation and it's grouping with other women. And there is power in our numbers. And once women are not alone, they have so much more to work with. And that's definitely a key element and key power of a rape crisis center and transition houses. Women have a chance to tell the truth. And we keep record of every story a woman told us, of who attacked her, how did he have access to her, what did he do to her, how did she survive, escaped or resisted. So somewhere in the world, there is a record of what this man did to this woman. And of course, if she want to go public with her story, either by using the criminal justice system or by other means, we will be behind her, because naming and shaming attacker is a very effective tool as well.
So before we get more about specifically Vancouver rape relief, can you talk a little bit more, just a tiny bit more, about, I mean, are there probably hotlines or relief centers that women can call all over the country? I mean, if they live in Edmonton or Toronto or in the United States in Louisville, Kentucky, is there probably a local place that will help, that will be able to help a woman?
Probably, yes. I think there is one of the achievements of the women's movement is the accumulation of all the stories that women told to so many centers around North America, made it such an undeniable phenomena that now many, many communities, most communities will have a service. But the backlash to this accumulation of truth is the eraser of who is attacking who. So a lot of rape crisis centers are not now responding to women fleeing male violence or experiencing rape or sexual assault. Now they will respond to people who experience sexual assault. So there is a complete erasure of who is the victim and who is the attacker, which reduce sexual assault to an individual phenomena that even though has huge magnitude, has been treated in depoliticized manner and with no lens of women's oppression. So with the mainstreaming and the acceptance of how prominent and how common violence against women is, the immediate backlash rendered it to depoliticized phenomena that happens between individual people.
I mean, I know from my own father that there will be a backlash, but it strikes me as extraordinary at all that there could be a backlash against something so wholesome as a battered women's shelter or a
right
or a rape relief center. Both of those.
It's true. I know that rape relief in particular had from the beginning, before my time, there were waves of backlash. So the first one that any transition house, I believe, in every community faced, that they're breaking the families, that they're undermining families and marriage. And I think in every community that there is a revelation of violence against women and there is attempt of women to group together and resist and offer support to other women, that's the most common response. But after that, Vancouver Rape Relief faced contradicting accusations. For example, the accusation that we are separatists, we're only organizing with women who were born females and raised as girls into womanhood. So there was a huge critique over that, but also there was a critique that we do work with men and we do believe that men are not inherently violent, they are trained to be violent, and men can change even though they don't choose to, and they will not until they will held accountable in significant numbers. But we work with men. We have a group of allies who agree to, because men have more money and they have access to other men with more money, agree to fundraise for us. It was first to buy our house, which we now completely own, and to give us the money without telling us how to spend it, which is unheard of in relationship, in economic relationship between men and women. And in return, we agreed to teach them about women's oppression. So we got hit for being separatist organization and for being working with men. Then we got hit for demanding, using the police, demanding that the criminal justice system will uphold the so-called democracy commitment to protect women. We got hit for that we're using the criminal justice system, and we also got hit for telling women you have alternatives. You want to do confrontation with a man, you want to shame and name him, you want to write him a letter, you want to do other things that are not within the law and order agenda, because the law and order agenda will never really get us to true freedom. So we got hit for that we're encouraging women to use alternative methods. So every decade there is has its backlash, and in the last, at least since I arrived, probably a little bit 5 to 10 years before that, the two main attacks against us is, one, our position on the abolition of prostitution, and one, the fact that we insist to organize and to respond to women who are born female. So the backlash of women's liberation is so profound and successful that prostitution and pornography are now held as a sexual liberation for women and not as the sexual exploitation and the oppression and the commodification of women. So now we are called anti-feminist because we do not respect women's choice, and the concept of choice is now completely abstract and turned upside down than what we meant. Choice is supposed to allow women to have control over our body, to have sexual autonomy, not to be commodified and used by men, and to maintain men entitlement on women's bodies. And the other issue is, of course, the key of what's going on these days is the fact that we insist that being born female in this world still means being born to the oppressed class of women, and it shapes our life in many, many ways. How we look, how we operate, what are we allowed to do, what we are rewarded for doing, and what are we not allowed to do. And from that experience, we organize, we support women, and we understand rape and sexual violence in that context. And not to say that others are being raped. Your own experience is one example. Boys and men and transgender people are raped by usually other men, because men are acting the violence against anybody who they see as not confirmed to the concept of masculinity. And our fight, all in all, to women's liberation will protect all these people, but there is a particular unique experience to being born to the oppressed class of women. And there is a growing liberal refusal to accept that.
So there was we don't have to spend a lot of time on this, but there was a lawsuit a while back that the Vancouver Rape Relief won that had to do with a male who identified as transgender, who insisted that he wanted to do what?
To volunteer. So Kimberly Nixon, in 1990, when they were 33, they lived all their life as a man, with a privilege that came with that. They were a pilot. They did reassignment surgery, so they were transsexual. And in 95, 5 years after, they came to Rape Relief asking to join training group, and the facilitator explained that they do not have the same life experience as women born females, and they cannot join us. The day after, they complained to the Human Rights Tribunal about discrimination. And ironically, they argued that we should not accept people who are self-identified as women, only people who had a sexual reassignment surgery. And it was dragged for 7 years, from 1995 to 2002, when the BC Human Rights Tribunal did accept that we acted in good faith, but did not accept our argument that you need to have, that there is a life experience that is unique to girls and women that is necessary for peer counseling, and ruled in favor of Nixon. But the Supreme Court of British Columbia in 2003 disagreed with those findings and ruled that it's not discrimination for a group to organize and to operate the way we are, and we have the freedom of association to organize as women-only organization. And Nixon appealed to that. So in 2005, the BC Court of Appeal accepted the previous decision that we allow to respond and organize with women who are born females. And then Nixon appealed to the Supreme Court of Canada, that in 2007 dismissed the appeal and ordered Nixon to pay us cost. So all the higher layers of the provincial and the Supreme Court of Canada accepted our position. But since then, there is a lot of misunderstanding of, there is a lot of untrue propaganda about, there is a new law now, or actually adaptation of the current law, both the Human Rights Federal Act and the Provincial Arts, that now adding gender identity to a protected ground. But sex, being born a female, is still a protected ground. So groups like ours have an exemption that allowed us to privilege one group and not to work with other groups to seek our mission, which is women's liberation.
couple of things. One of them is that it seems that if a woman who has been severely traumatized by a man or men is going to seek help from violence by members of that group, men, it seems more than obvious to me that there should be places where she can be free of, and we can use whatever language we want. I would say men, but I don't live in Canada, so we can say those who were, that she should be free to associate only with those who are not of the sex that beat and assaulted her.
Absolutely. And
it seems crazy to me.
Yeah, well, it's a common sentiment among women who call us and women who are staying in a transition house that they want to share their experience with people, in this case, women who were born female, who have similar experience, because the element of sexual assault or rape are not, we do not understand it as an isolated incident in the context of our life, in the context of our life as women. And there is immediate comfort and immediate intimacy and immediate understanding that women get from calling us and coming to our house, knowing I'm among my own. And that experience is not existing when someone who did not share this experience is participating in that formation. Absolutely.
I know women who have been traumatized by men, mm-hmm. who, when they go to a therapist, they have to choose a female therapist because a man is too frightening, given what they don't want to open up to a man because of what they went through with men. And I mean, I've seen this in my own family. I've seen this in mm-hmm. close friends. It again seems just really, sorry to keep banging on about this, but it just...
No, I think it's definitely one of the key issues.
I can see somebody who is calling a rape crisis center, and if someone who was born male, to use Canadian language, answers the phone, then I can see them just hanging up and not calling back.
Yeah. By the way, it's not Canadian language. It's really us. It's a way to try to find a way to say what we say and what we think without creating too much drama. Not that it helps, right? I constantly mispronounce people, and there is the language policing is out of control here, but just the simplest way to deal with it is saying male and female, even though there is a denial of it's still considered here to be transphobic. I am still accused of being transphobic if I call people who were born male and now self-identify as women, as if I even say that they were born male, and if I do not accept that they are, on their definition, female, because the legislation here is a bit, I don't want to, like, the word crazy is a bit of a controversial word, but it just doesn't make any sense. People now can change their birth certificate to say that they were female when they were born.
Which is destroying the meaning of the word female, which,
yes.
which has a scientific, specific, biophysical meaning.
Yes. And there is also a terminology that now people, trans activists will say, or people self-declared trans rights activists will say, that they were assigned at birth. They're actually in conception. They were male or female. It's not that the doctor was prejudiced and just decided that if someone was born with a penis, he's a male. So there is a thing that we consider to be a very, very basic factual scientific fact are now being ignored, let alone rejected. So...
So we have, you and I have to stop talking for a minute about men's violence against women so that we can talk about the Orwellian use of language. I mean,
okay.
I mean, that's, no, I'm just saying that's what we just did. That's,
right.
That's which is one of the points of this whole thing, to distract attention from the question
yeah.
of men's violence against women,
yes.
and to get us
yes.
get us talking in circles about. I mean, it's crazy whether, you know, to say that somebody was assigned male or female at birth.
Yeah.
That's like saying they were assigned mammal at birth. No, you are
yeah.
a mammal.
Yeah.
Anyway.
It just, the fact that people's internal feelings are now become a scientific fact. And there is another very common accusation that we are, people in our present are not feeling safe because we do not accept their, how they identify themselves. As an anti-violence worker, and you're the victim of violence, the male violence, you saw your mom and your sister heard the male violence, the word safety is holy for us. Safety means you're in real danger. Like, when women say we're not safe, we, like, where are you? I'm going to bring you here. I'm calling the police. Safety means there is a danger to your life. And here the word safety has completely been bastardized and accused in really in a contradicting meaning about people's discomfort. So, yeah, the language games are really out of control here.
So another thing that bothers me about that original lawsuit is I don't, and I want to get up to the present in a moment, but I don't, so decades ago, Ward Churchill wrote an essay slamming a book by Gerrymander. And I asked my friend Jeanette Armstrong what she thought about his essay. And she said if Ward didn't like the book, he should have written his own damn book.
Mm.
And that has been central to my life ever since then, in terms of the reason I write the books I do is because I didn't like the books I was seeing out there on environmental
mm-hmm.
issues, and so I
mm-hmm.
just wrote my own instead of complaining
mm-hmm.
about theirs.
Mm-hmm.
And the people who started Vancouver Rape Relief, I'm guessing, they saw that there needed to be this place, and instead of just complaining about it, they made it. And so if somebody doesn't like the work that you're doing, I don't understand why they don't just start their own rape crisis center. You know,
yes,
we want to have a bazillion of them?
Right. And there is so much need. And not only that, definitely there is no debate that transgender people, I'm not sure in Vancouver, but general, I think an American researcher that interviewed 27,000 people, transgender people, and the high level of violence experience. And I have no doubt with that, because we know as lesbians, as feminists, people who do not conform with a gender construction of what it means to be a man or a woman will be punished. And transgender people, I'm sure, are being punished by other men. But so I'm not sure it's applied to Vancouver, but it definitely applied to many, many conservative parts in North America and people, all people, including transgender people. And it's crazy that I need even to say that because it's so obvious. Everybody needs safety. Everybody deserves dignity. And there should be more services for everybody. And if transgender people like the model that we have, they should organize in that structure, which means it's a service designed by transgender people, delivered to transgender people by transgender people. So, exactly. And not only that, what we're facing is not just criticism and complaint. We face an active, aggressive, bullying move to really crush us. That's where people are taking their anger at us or their criticism to us. It's not just, I don't like that rape crisis center, I'll have my own rape crisis center, I don't like that rape center. There is a direct, aggressive attempt to take us down. And that's have been in the making for 20 years. And a lot of liberal people and elected officials are supporting that move, sometimes from ignorance and sometimes because they don't want to stand up for women's rights, really, and sometimes because it's an easy way to deny the particular experience that women have in this world.
So talk a little bit more explicitly, if you want to, and if you don't, that's okay, about the most recent set of attacks on Vancouver Rape Relief.
So a couple of years ago, in terms of funding, it started a couple of years ago, the BC Federation of Labor, which should be a natural ally and should understand the concept of self-organizing. It's an umbrella organization for the labor unions in British Columbia, passed a resolution that saying, they did not name us, but when they lobbied for it, they said it's about their belief that instructing their membership not to support financially organizations who do not accept transgender women as women. So that's happened, I think, 2 years ago. And another thing that happened during those processes, there were a lot of, not a lot, but quite a few people who kind of having testimonies of how badly they were treated by rape relief. And when you look into the case, just now we had Wynonna LaDuke visiting Vancouver and speaking in our event, and someone wrote on her Facebook that she's doing an amazing job, but she's been supporting transphobic organization. And we had a chance to meet with her, so she knew who we are, and it's easier to defend us when you actually know us personally and you see how we operate. So she defended us, and they wrote back saying, this person wrote back, well, they harm trans men, they harmed me in particular, I was a collective member, they're harming trans people. That, when I looked into the background of this case, that person was a lesbian collective member who was hired as a paid staff and did not pass probation years after they transitioned. So there is so many, there is not even grains of truth. There are a few separate facts that are now repacked to trash rape relief. And every time we take all those complaints really seriously. So when we dig and we find out what exactly happened, it's so removed from what is being said. But so that's, there were people on the stage speaking to thousands of people trashing us and our services. And that was the first attempt to undermine us financially. And recently we have a new city council in Vancouver, and we've been historically, I think more than a decade, maybe even 2 decades, receiving small amount of money for our public education work. And public education is such an important tool for social change, so we're very intentional to make the public education event really open to the public. They're always free, and even if there are tickets, there are always a possibility for free tickets. They always have childcare, always wheelchair accessible. We often provide food so people with no means can have free food, but we're really making it available to everybody. It doesn't matter what's your sex, what your gender, how you identify yourself, and with particular intention for people economic abilities. And that their financial support helps us do that. And there were people who self-declared as trans activists who lobbied to the city council, and when the moment of truth came, the city council decided that they will give us a grant for this year, but unless we change our position to be inclusive to all what they define women, we will not continue receiving money. And there is no other group, like many, many groups in the city are receiving money that is designated to work with particular groups, Chinese seniors and Native youth. And of course, they're not expected to now support people with different age and different ethnicity and different language. The work that they do is designed for particular groups, but only the feminist, radical feminist group who's insisting that our work is for women's liberation now face this sanction. And it's not dramatic in terms of the money. We already got so many, more than 1,000 people gave small donations that we already secured for this particular budget line for next year. But it did embolden the opposition or our enemy, because they now find a way to really take us down. And we made a public commitment, both in the city when there was a long hearing, and I was asked if we would be willing to consider some training or opening some services, and I said no, we will not yield. There is a principled reason to why we operate the way we operate, and we're not going to change it for funding needs. But we will stay open. The fact that we own our own house and the fact that we are mainly volunteer-led collective means that, like with individual women, when you have money, you can do what you want. So we will never be in a position that the government or our enemy will shape the work that we do. and we will keep our doors open and our crisis line operating. But it was, it emboldened our enemy that they can so easily influence elective officials to undermine rape relief.
So I don't understand. So a couple months ago, I interviewed Carla Mantilla, the author of Gender Trolling, How Misogyny Went Viral.
Okay.
And she writes about online bullying by males of any woman who speaks out.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw this recently with how the woman who ran the team that had the first picture of the black hole, how just for being a woman, she was horribly abused all over the internet.
Mm-hmm.
And it is commonly accepted. I mean, it's commonly understood that men abuse women in real life, and you know, the gold standard studies are that 25% of all women are raped in their lifetime, another 19% fend off rape attempt, which means that it's a lot of men doing it.
Right.
And I don't understand how this whole movement to attempt to force females to allow males into every group, I don't understand how that is not seen as part of this MRA backlash to the rights that women have gained over the past, and the rights that women have not just gained but struggled for and taken over the last 50 years.
It's true, and it's a very strategic fight because people should have compassion to transgender people. And it's similar to the fight with prostitution. People have compassion to women in prostitution, especially street prostitution, what they call survival. I don't use the term sex work, but what is called by the liberal survival sex work. But then, so there is harnessing of that compassion to call for a campaign that completely undermines women's rights. The answer to prostitution and to street prostitution is real choices for women. And sanctioning the men who's preying on them, buying them, pimping them. The answer to transgender people is, yeah, have services, have protection, have safety and dignity. Do not undermine women's liberation. But I think it's a very sophisticated, progressive backlash against women. It's in the name of compassion. That's why it's so sophisticated. It's in the name of compassion. It's the name of caring. It's the name of standing by the underdog to taking down women's rights and women's and bold women. And you have no idea how many emails or face-to-face conversation we had with strong, impressive, powerful women in the academy and in other places that they say, we're terrified to speak about that. There is an immediate sanctioning when you take the sensible, reasonable, feminist stance on supporting women's rights to self-organize. There is such a terror and fascism element around anybody who will not go along with the party line. That there is one city council member who tweeted, transgender women are women, sex work is work, and anybody that's the party line, and anybody who dare forget, disagree, question that, is being immediately bullied and named transphobic, hatred, hate speech, inciting violence. There is no legitimacy to free speech or to free thought in the name of progressive values. That was so crazy about it. It comes from the left.
And I think, I mean, it all fits within the context of abusive tactics anyway, because this is something that, you know, one of the reasons my mother stayed, as I said before,
mm-hmm.
was because there weren't battered women's shelters. But another
right.
reason she stayed was because of her love for her children, because
mm-hmm.
she didn't see the alternatives. And my father used the children as pawns in his attempts to control
yeah.
her.
Yeah.
And this is just absolutely classic. I mean, there's that word, DARVO. What is it? Deny, attack, reverse victim and offender. That's just classic abusive behavior, and this happens
yeah.
on the larger social scale too.
Right.
I mean, we have only a few minutes left. We have 5 or 6 minutes left, and I just, you know, ever since we set this interview up, there's just one line that has kept coming to me, which is, what sort of monster would it take to defund and to work to campaign to defund a rape relief center? I mean, that's like defunding an organization. I'm not comparing women to puppies, but it's like defunding an organization that takes care of puppies who've been tortured, you know? It's like,
right.
there's no downside to a center providing help for women who have been assaulted. And
yes,
it strikes me as extraordinary that anyone could rationalize defunding any organization, not just your organization, but any organization mm-hmm. that is providing relief for the most traumatized. Do you see what I'm getting
right.
at?
Yeah, it's a very vicious attack. The claim of the other side, including the politicians who voted for this decision that it will not be funded again, that they, of course, we're doing an amazing work, we're so important. I did Freedom of Information, so we saw the city council members receive hundreds of letters from people who said they're in support of us, or women said, I use their services, how dare you? So the claim is they do not want to undermine us. They want to convince us to change our position. So I think they did not anticipate that we will keep our head high and say you cannot bully us to change the way we operate. But I think that's all they will say. They will not say we want to crush them or undermine that. We just want them to change their ways. But it's a bullying move. It's anti-democratic in our minds, and it's not going to work. We just we have enough confidence in our politics. We have enough support in our community. We're not going to go anyway. It just takes a lot of time and effort that are distracting us or making it harder to do the work that we do need to do, respond to women fleeing male violence.
Well, we have just a couple minutes left. Are there... I guess I have a couple, three questions. One of them is, so if somebody wants to learn more about Vancouver Rape Relief or more broadly about men's violence against women, what can they do?
So our website is pretty comprehensive. In particular, it has some international basic feminist analysis, but also some data on male violence in Canada, and we also have a Facebook, so people are invited, Vancouver Rape Relief and Women's Shelter, just to follow and see what's around, and we often refer to other sources, so they will find other places to go if they start with our own website.
So another sort of larger book question is, Susan Griffin's Pornography and Silence was really important to me. Andrea Dworkin's work was really important to me. Mary Daly's work was really important to me. Can you name a few writers people might want to read if they are readers and want to learn more about some basic feminism?
So yeah, Andrea Dworkin definitely is a prominent writer that we read her books and offering it to other people. Good books about incest, mainly about incest. One is Trauma and Recovery by Judith Louis Thurman. Okay, that's good. I brought the Hebrew version with me from Jerusalem and bought so many English copies since to give to callers and to my fellow collective members. So yeah, it's a very powerful book and really, really sharp, brilliant analysis. And you should actually interview her because she's getting older. She cannot travel, but it will be good. I have her contact information because I was hoping to bring her here, so you should consider that.
You know, I will interview her, and I have to just say I'm going to name drop again because I interviewed her back in 1996 or 7.
Oh, my God.
And most important interview I ever did.
Oh, I believe that. Yes, I can see that.
Judith Herman's who we're talking about. She's fabulous.
Yes, really, really. And also it's a very easy-to-read book full of compassion and brilliancy, so yeah. So I would recommend that. In general, as feminist reading, we always recommend the Red Stocking collective writing. They're very accessible also online about the, it's kind of archaic and kind of still timely, more timely than ever. These are probably the basic books on our reading list. There are particular Canadian books. There is Obsession with Intent that Lee Lakeman, our honorary collective member, wrote. And Audre Lorde, Adrienne Rich, but I would Judith Lewis Herman, Andrea Dworkin, the Red Stocking Collective, I think, are very, very basic and very, very good. And I understand there is a new book by Andrea Dworkin, collection of some old and unpublished writings that we need to put our hand. And, of course, Sheila Jeffries. Her writing is very good on all kind of issues, including the gender situation right now, the self-identified transgender people. And, yeah. I'm going to make sure that our reading list on our website is up to date in case one of your listeners want to check what we recommend.
Okay. And my last question is, and I know you can't give a real answer to this, but if somebody is listening to this and is a woman who is in a bad situation of some sort, a bad long-term situation, what can she start to do?
I would tell her actually to call us. If she's not from Vancouver, if she's anywhere in North America, she can call us Collect. Our number is 604-1-604-872-8212. And we can advise her from there. But the first basic rules, and sometimes it's very, very hard with children, is to get out. To get out, take your children with you, take some basic papers with you, go to a safe place and call any service, any transition house, any shelter from there. But she can call us. We have relationship and alliances and resources all over North America. And we can direct her to a place that we know will be. Sometimes it's just hard to make 15 phone calls. You have one phone call to make, and then in another day you can make another phone call. So she can make the first phone call to us, and we will do our research. And so next time she calls, we can offer a few real options to her.
Well, thank you so much for all of your incredible work, and thank you for being on the program. I would
of
like
course.
To thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Hilla Kerner. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.